From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Iraq crisis. And despite a ceasefire, there's been more violence in eastern Ukraine. More kidnappings in Nigeria, cultivating Africa's human resources, plus the World Cup continuing in Brazil. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The first of up to 300 military advisors President Obama committed to help Iraq counter a Sunni militant surge have begun their mission. Pentagon spokesperson Rear Admiral John Kirby.
We have begun to deploy initial assessment teams, two special operations teams of approximately 40 personnel previously assigned to the embassy through the Office of Security Cooperation have started their new mission. In addition, approximately 90 additional troops assigned to help stand up the Baghdad Joint Operations Center have arrived on station in Baghdad. Within the next few days, these troops will be joined by four additional teams of approximately 50 people total who will deploy to Iraq from within the Central Command region. These teams will assess the cohesiveness and readiness of Iraqi security forces, higher headquarters, in Baghdad, and examine the most effective and efficient way to introduce follow-on advisors.
Kirby also spoke about U.S. air surveillance over Iraq.
We continue to fly routine and regular ISR missions over Iraq to the tune of about 30 to 35 flights per day to help us gain better insight about the security situation on the ground. This continued effort will no doubt aid our assessment teams as they begin their important work.
Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Tuesday with Iraq's Kurdish leader in an effort to convince him to close ranks with the government in Baghdad to fend off the Sunni militants. We get more now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Secretary Kerry's visit to Kurdistan came amid a new round of conflicting reports. Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant militants had captured Iraq's largest oil refinery at Beji, north of Tikrit. VOA could not independently confirm who is in control of Beji. Amateur video showed the aftermath of a bombing raid over the militant-controlled Iraqi border town of Qa'im facing Syria. Witnesses claim Syrian warplanes bombed militant positions from the air. In Kurdistan, Secretary Kerry thanked Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani for helping battle the militants during their meeting. He went on to stress that resolving the current conflict revolves around forming an inclusive new government in Baghdad.
As everybody knows, this is a very critical time for Iraq as a whole, and the government formation challenge is the central challenge that we face. In recent days, the security cooperation between the forces here in the Kurdish area have been really critical to helping to draw a line with respect to ISIL and also to provide some support to the Iraqi security forces.
But Mr. Barzani was cautious about cooperating with the Baghdad forces.
لكن لا يمكن أن نقاتل بدون أن يكون هناك.
He says it is impossible to fight the militants without a clear future, a complete agreement, and a complete political solution. Secretary Kerry told U.S. broadcaster CBS that President Barack Obama is not planning to help the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki with air support due to the lack of a political consensus among Iraqi leaders. He said it would be a total act of irresponsibility for the president to order airstrikes when the current Iraqi government is not unified. Prime Minister Maliki has vowed to form a new government by a July 1 constitutional deadline, but he appears to be increasingly challenged by Sunni and Shiite political adversaries. Mr. Maliki does appear to still have the backing of his country's chief power broker, Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United Nations is accusing ISIL of wide-ranging human rights violations in Iraq. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where investigators say the Sunni militants have killed hundreds of civilians, wounded many more since its invasion of Iraqi cities began early this month.
According to UN investigators, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant has been accumulating a large and grisly record of gross human rights violations since its invasion of northern Iraq early this month. Human rights investigators working with the UN Assistance Mission in Iraq say they have verified numerous alleged violations perpetrated by this group. But they say the numbers they cite of civilians killed and injured are underestimated. The UN report finds at least 757 civilians were killed and 599 injured in Nineveh, Diyala, and Salah al-Din provinces between June 5th and 22. UN Human Rights Spokesman Rupert Colville says these figures include summary executions and extrajudicial killings of civilians, police, and soldiers who were not fighting.
At least another 318 people were killed and a further 590 injured during the same period in Baghdad and areas in the south, many of them as a result of at least six separate vehicle-borne bombs. Abductions continue to be reported in the northern provinces and in Baghdad. These include a number of cases of foreigners, such as the 48 Turkish citizens abducted from Turkey's consulate when ISIL captured Mosul.
The UN Assistance Mission in Iraq documents the cases of dozens of other foreigners, as well as Shia civilians and members of minority groups that have been abducted in Mosul, Baghdad, and other places. It says some of those kidnapped have been released, while others have been subsequently found dead, in some cases by summary execution. The report highlights dozens of videos broadcast by ISIL showing cruel treatment and beheadings and shootings of soldiers and police officers out of combat. It says some of these people apparently are targeted because of their religion or ethnicity. But Colville also says the Iraqi army has allegedly carried out at least two summary executions of prisoners and the killing of 31 detainees at a police station. He says these cases still are not verified.
UNAMI human rights officers have, however, confirmed another reported summary execution of prisoners by ISF personnel as they withdrew from the Nineveh Operations Command Center in Mosul. In this case, grenades were reportedly thrown into rooms filled with detainees, killing at least 10 and injuring another 14.
The United Nations is urging the Iraqi authorities to swiftly and thoroughly investigate these alleged crimes. Colville says the United Nations will continue to collect evidence of wrongdoing by ISIL. He says the information could be used to bring the perpetrators to justice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Suspected Islamist militants have carried out another mass kidnapping in Nigeria's northeastern Borno state, same region where more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by Boko Haram militants in April. Local officials and residents say the gunmen seized 60 women and girls and possibly more than 30 boys during raids Tuesday on several villages about 100 kilometers from the state capital, Maiduguri. They say the gunmen killed at least four villagers during the attacks. There's been no claim of responsibility. Meantime, Cameroon's military has arrested dozens of suspected Boko Haram militants, and as Moki Edwin Kinzika reports, soldiers also sealed off a market where they suspect Boko Haram may be hiding arms for use in the insurgency over the border in Nigeria.
Cameroon State Radio broadcast that heavily armed soldiers stormed one of the largest markets in northern Cameroon, arrested suspected Boko Haram members, and seized an undisclosed quantity of equipment.
A gendarmerie raid on the Marwa Central Market has led to the arrest of over 40 people. The arrest is in connection with ongoing investigations into the activities of the Boko Haram Islamist group in the far north region of the country.
Marwa businessman Wanika Baba, in an interview with the private Danai FM radio station, says many of the arrested were his peers and there is confusion in the community.
Je comprends pas. On a fermé le marché depuis deux jours.
He says he does not understand what is happening as the military has had the market sealed for 2 days now and have arrested so many people. He says children and women are suffering from the closure and no one knows the fate of those arrested. Colonel Nyemek Pierre, who led the military raid, tells VOA that the central government ordered the military action as part of its fight against Boko Haram incursions into Cameroon.
Maintenant, c'est justement le rôle de la gendarmerie. Quand il y a flux de population, c'est la gendarmerie qui
sait. It is the duty of the military, he says, to filter the population so that enemies do not infiltrate into Cameroon. He adds that the matter is complicated because along the border, there are Nigerians and Cameroonians who belong to the same families, and soldiers have to try to distinguish who is a militant. This is the first time Cameroon's military has carried out an operation on such a large scale in a single day. Northern Cameroon has been plagued for almost a year with an influx of refugees and militants from strife in neighboring Central African Republic and the Boko Haram violence in northern Nigeria. Authorities in Cameroon have been urging citizens along the border, particularly with Nigeria's Borno State, the heart of the Boko Haram insurgency, to cooperate with the government by providing information on suspected sympathizers with the Islamist sect. The government here believes Boko Haram is now expanding its recruiting into Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
At least 18 people have been killed in retaliatory clashes between Christians and Muslims in the Central African Republic. Witnesses say the unrest began after gunmen who claimed to be from the mostly Christian anti-Balaka militia attacked Muslims in a village. They say most of those killed in the fighting were members of the Muslim Fulani minority. In a Tuesday report, the International Federation for Human Rights said that the anti-Balaka, mostly Muslim Salika rebels, mirror one another in the horror of the acts that they perpetrated in the CAR. The group said it found evidence of crimes, including extrajudicial executions, rape, and the recruitment of child soldiers during recent fact-finding missions in the CAR. Human rights groups urged the CAR government to set up a special unit to investigate the alleged atrocities. A Christian woman sentenced to death in Sudan and later freed was detained at an airport while trying to leave the country on Tuesday. Tabit Suleiman, one of 27-year-old Miriam Ibrahim's lawyers, said she was held along with her two children and her husband at the international airport in Khartoum. He did not elaborate, and security officials did not respond to requests for comments. At the U.S. State Department in Washington, spokesperson Marie Harf told the media that the Sudanese government had informed American officials at the embassy in Khartoum that Ibrahim and her family were temporarily detained over issues relating to their travel documents.
The government has assured us of their safety. The embassy has been and will remain highly involved in working with the family and the government. We are engaging directly with Sudanese officials to secure their safe and swift departure from Sudan. And of course, we'll provide more information as we get it.
Ibrahim, whose father was Muslim but not was raised by her Christian mother, was convicted of apostasy for marrying a Christian. Sudan's penal code forbids Muslims from converting to other religions. It's a crime punishable by death. However, on Monday, a Sudanese court threw out Ibrahim's death sentence and freed her after a presentation by her legal team. A number of Sudanese have been convicted of apostasy in recent years, but they all escaped execution by recanting their new faith. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says he will not interfere with judicial verdicts in which a Cairo court sentenced three Al Jazeera journalists to 7 years in prison on charges of supporting the banned Muslim Brotherhood and spreading false news. The sentences announced Monday for Australian Peter Grest, Egyptian-Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Baher Mohamed drew harsh reactions from leaders and press freedom groups around the world. Egypt defended the Cairo court's ruling and rejected foreign reaction as interference in its internal affairs. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said Tuesday the Egyptian justice system has the right to make its own decisions, but that Australia was bewildered by the ruling.
Yes, we understand the need of the Egyptian government to maintain internal order and to crack down on extremism, including the Muslim Brotherhood. But it is important that there be due process. It is important that decisions be made on a fair and just basis.
Australia summoned Egypt's ambassador to protest Gress' conviction, and Peter Gress' father, Juris Gress, told reporters Tuesday in Brisbane that the family will continue to fight until the journalists are freed.
This is a very dark time, not only for our family, but for journalism generally. We are devastated, shocked, and dismayed at this finding. We are not usually a family of superlatives, but I have to say this morning, my vocabulary fails to convey just how shattered we are.
Al Jazeera has always maintained its employees were simply reporting the news. The network's acting general director, Mustafa Swag, called the verdict shocking and said Al Jazeera will continue its international campaign to free its journalist. Head of the International Fund for Agricultural Development says that Africa's greatest resource is its people. He calls on leaders to heavily invest in their workforce or risk continent-wide poverty by the year 2030. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Kenyayo Nwanze's comments come in an open letter to the 23rd AU Summit on Agriculture and Food Security. It's being held in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, through June 27th.
Someone in my capacity as an African as well should be able to speak openly and frankly with our heads of state. I think it's a moral obligation, it's a moral imperative, because I believe that Africa, again, is at the crossroads.
He says people are Africa's best resource, including the 200 million between the ages of 15 and 24.
Now, that's a very powerful resource base. And when you also realize that that population of 200 million young people, oftentimes unemployed, if we waste their future, it's going to be a great loss for the continent. These are the future leaders of Africa. We have to give them hope. We have to give them something to look forward to. And I think if we don't sow the seeds for that hope now, we're going to have a very explosive situation within the next decade.
He says if African leaders don't act now, the continent will account for 80% of the world's poor by 2030, a figure, he says, is supported by data from the World Bank and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization.
Africa is the only region in the world where the numbers of the poor have increased.
And Nwanze calls on African leaders to deliver development now, with the priority on rural people.
Food does not grow in cities. Food grows in rural areas. If you do not invest in the youth, particularly in the rural areas, if you do not make agriculture attractive to them, to create jobs, to generate wealth, to give them some sense of dignity, what is going to happen? They will continue to migrate from the rural areas to the urban cities. You end up with what you call the urban bulge.
He says that would lead to many disenchanted young people living in slums and susceptible to crime.
When we talk about poverty, when we talk about inequalities in Africa, it is basically an inequality between the rural and the urban space.
More than 10 years ago, African leaders committed to the Maputo Declaration. It required that at least 10% of national budgets be devoted to agriculture and rural development. The IFAD president says only 7 countries have fulfilled that commitment. And Nwanze says such investment is critical on a continent where 20 states are classified as fragile and 28 countries need food assistance. He gives 3 recommendations for leaders at the AU summit. Make investment in agriculture and rural development a priority, including infrastructure, energy, and roads. Second, invest in education, particularly of women. And third, provide social services. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine says pro-Russian separatists near the Russian border shot down a Ukrainian military helicopter on Tuesday, killing at least 9 servicemen. It happened near the eastern city of Sloviansk less than a day after rebels announced a temporary ceasefire and their push to gain autonomy from the Kiev government. Meantime, a senior UN human rights official says that over the last 2 weeks, the number of displaced persons in Ukraine has doubled to more than 46,000 and could be higher. In his briefing to the UN Security Council on Tuesday, Ivan Simonovich said the situation in eastern Ukraine is rapidly deteriorating. We get more now from VOA's Margaret Bashir at the UN.
Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Simonovich briefed on the latest findings of the 34-person team of monitors dispatched to Ukraine in March by the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Simonovich said eastern Ukraine is experiencing serious human rights challenges, including abductions and detentions by armed groups and the reported excessive use of force and enforced disappearances during government security operations. As a result, civilians are becoming displaced.
The population is leaving partly due to fear, but also because of the worsening situation of economic and social rights.
Speaking to the council from Croatia via a video link, Simonovich said over the last 2 weeks, the UN Refugee Agency has profiled more than 46,000 displaced persons, more than 35,000 from the east and 11,500 from Crimea, which was annexed by Russia in March. He said the number is likely to be higher because there is no formal registration system. Simonovich said from mid-April to June 20th, an estimated 423 people, including military personnel and civilians, were killed in eastern Ukraine. He welcomed President Petro Poroshenko's recently announced peace plan and unilateral ceasefire and the declaration by armed groups that they would observe a truce until Friday. But that appeared in jeopardy Tuesday as a Ukrainian military helicopter was reported shot down by rebels near the eastern town of Sloviansk. In Moscow, President Vladimir Putin asked Parliament to revoke the right it granted him in March to send the Russian military into Ukraine to defend Russian nationals and Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Several Security Council members welcomed the development, but said it must be genuinely reflected on the ground. They also expressed support for President Poroshenko's peace plan and concern for 8 international monitors who have been held by separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk for nearly a month. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
And World Cup football action in Brazil on Tuesday. Uruguay defeated Italy 1-0. And Tuesday's other Group D match, Costa Rica and England, played to a scoreless draw. Costa Rica had already clinched first place in the group after earlier upset wins over Uruguay and Italy. In Group C, Greece defeated Ivory Coast 2-1, and Colombia won a 4-1 match over Japan. Also, we should note that Brazil, Mexico, and Chile will all have earned berths in the second round after the Netherlands had previously clinched a spot from Group B. And in the next round, Brazil will face Chile and the Netherlands will be playing Mexico. And all 64 matches will be played by the time of the final match on July the 13th. Round of 16 will begin on June 28th, the quarterfinals underway on July 4th, and the semifinals on July 8th. And a reminder, you can find out all about the World Cup on Twitter at VOA Football or on the internet at voafootball.com. Tiger Woods, the golfer, recovering from back surgery. Well, it was quicker than expected, but he said he probably would not have returned at this week's Quicken Loans National event in the U.S. state of Maryland unless it benefited his charity foundation. Woods has been away from the game for 3 months and is taking part in this week's tournament at the Congressional Country Club just outside of Washington. The 14 times major winner has his goal to play in the British Open next month. The Tiger Woods Foundation, begun by the golfer in 1996 to reach millions of young people, he says, by delivering educational opportunities worldwide. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is coming your way shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On June 25, 1942, Major General Dwight D. Eisenhower took command of U.S. forces in Europe. Eisenhower had never seen combat during his 27 years as an Army officer, but he proved himself a capable leader on the battlefields of North Africa and Italy and was appointed as Supreme Commander of Allied forces during the invasion of Europe. Eisenhower later served two terms as U.S. president. In the pre-dawn hours of June 25, 1950, armed forces from Communist North Korea crossed the 38th parallel into South Korea, setting off the Korean War. With U.N. approval, the United States and other foreign powers intervened and pushed north almost to the Chinese border. But that prompted China's intervention, which forced U.N. forces south. After the fighting reached a stalemate, an armistice was signed in 1953. On this day in 1991, Slovenia and Croatia declared their independence, initiating the breakup of the Yugoslav Republic. That move was opposed by Yugoslavia, which initiated a war characterized by the use of heavy weapons to attack urban areas and the use of terrorism to drive away local populations, a procedure that became known as ethnic cleansing. And on this day in 1967, the Beatles appeared on the first live global television link before an estimated 400 million viewers in 26 countries. Asked to perform a song that contained a simple message that could be understood by all nationalities, the Beatles came up with a tune that would become their 14th number one hit in the United States. And that's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vital Voices, a U.S.-based international non-governmental organization that trains and mentors women leaders around the world in the areas of political participation, economic development, and human rights, recently awarded its Global Trailblazer Award to Syrian human rights defender Razan Zeytuneh. Her sister Rana accepted the award on her behalf at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Ms. Zeytuneh is a 37-year-old lawyer who represented Syrian political prisoners across sectarian lines for years. In 2007, she created Syria's first human rights information bank to document violations and publish them to the world. A supporter of peaceful democratic reform and nonviolent civil resistance, she elected to stay in Syria and continue her work in 2011, even after fighting erupted and the regime officially denounced her. Razan Zeytuneh detailed the abuses and the atrocities occurring in Syria and also founded the Violations Documentation Center. In December 2013, Ms. Zeytuneh was abducted, along with her husband and two colleagues, reportedly from the office of the Violations Documentation Center in Douma, near Damascus. Her whereabouts remain unknown, and no individual or group has claimed responsibility for her disappearance. During a speech in London at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke of Razan Zeytuneh.
Razan has risked her life inside Syria to care for political prisoners and call attention to human rights violations, including against women. We stand in awe of her leadership and heroism.
Secretary of State Kerry once again called for the release of Razan Zeytuneh, as well as the release of thousands of detained and disappeared human rights defenders in Syria and around the globe. We need to stand up and stand by them, said Mr. Kerry. Their voices must not be silenced.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.